This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, this is Power and Politics. I'm David Cochrane in Ottawa. Hamas says it accepts a new ceasefire proposal, but Israel says the deal Hamas has agreed to may not be acceptable.
We are at a critical stage right now.
This news comes just hours after Israel told people sheltering in Rafah to evacuate, warning of a military ground operation. Will Israel and Hamas be able to come to an agreement, or will the war continue to escalate? The federal government introduces legislation aimed at curbing foreign interference. This just days after a public inquiry found foreign meddling in the last two elections undermined trust in democracy. The federal government has tabled legislation that would modernize how Canada's spy agency collects and shares intelligence. The legislation comes days after a public inquiry said attempts by other countries to meddle in Canada's past two elections undermined Canadians' trust in democracy.
Digital technologies are a part of every aspect of our lives, and this new context calls for CSIS to be more agile in how it can conduct its investigations. This is precisely what this legislation would achieve.
For more on this, I'm joined by Ward Elcock, who is a former director of CSIS. Ward, long time no see. It's just Friday you were here. You heard there from Dominic LeBlanc talking about this will allow CSIS to be more agile in the way it conducts its investigations. How does this boost the agility of the spy agency?
Well, I assume what it does, and it's a fairly long piece of legislation, and a lot of it is fairly complex. So understanding exactly what every provision does is not something you can do in 20 minutes
or
half an
hour. Of course,
But I assume what they're doing is they're tidying up a bunch of things that deal with investigation, but also clearly they're giving the service a greater ability to talk to people about issues that may come up in investigations. Now, that's going to create its own problems, but that was something the government signaled that it intended to do.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about the importance of that because, you know, throughout this, like there's the internal information sharing gaps of whether the PMO was told or the public safety minister was told. This is about a broader series of information sharing at municipal governments, you know, universities and private companies. What is the benefit of giving CSIS that specific range of powers and any downside you might see?
Well, the benefits are that it can talk to people because up until this point, the service was limited really to providing information to the government and then the government deciding what it would do with it.
Right.
So giving the service the ability to do that means that it can be more direct. It will be more challenging for the service because it will have to take some decisions about what information does it share and doesn't share. And there is a potential to create problems in an investigation by sharing too much. I think some of people's concerns that people be informed are probably unrealistic. Really, for example, it escapes me that Mr. Chong needed to know that the Chinese were interested in finding out something about his relatives. It's not clear to me, apart from the fact that he is a member of parliament, why that would even be an issue.
Why wouldn't he want to know that? I mean, if it feels...
There's nothing he can do about it, and there's nothing the service can really do about it, except if somebody actually carries out that activity in Canada. But the reality is the Chinese are going to find that information out in China. They control Hong Kong. They're not going to have any barrier to finding that information. They may have tried to do it here for simplicity, but ultimately they'll get that information at home, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
So the argument today in allowing CSIS to speak more broadly with people was that it could help build resilience. For example, we've heard about alleged meddling by the Chinese state in the Vancouver municipal elections, for example. And we've heard from the former mayor, Kennedy Stewart, that they were briefed by CSIS on what was happening, but it was maddening because of the lack of specificity.
And they may still have that problem.
Right.
Because, again, you're talking about top secret information. It may be information derived from a warrant. It may be information derived from a sensitive operation from
right.
a human source or whatever. So the information they share may still not be enough, the kind of information that people imagine they should be getting. Now, whether they should be getting it or not is a question that the service is going to have to consider before it shares anything, and that's going to be a tough that's going to be tough to manage, I think.
There would at least be the opportunity, as I understand it, the way these changes were explained today, is that you could go to an organization, a municipality, a company or whatever, and say, you're being targeted by a foreign state. These are the ways they tend to do this. These are the steps you should take to protect yourselves. And right now, they haven't been able to do that necessarily.
So there are ways in which they can do some of that and ways in which we have done some of that in the past. But the reality is that was hard to do. This will make it easier, and that will happen more easily. And that's not a bad thing necessarily, but it will involve some tough choices from time to time.
It's still unclear to me how a legislative framework that we've only just seen could help overcome the challenges of turning intelligence into evidence to take certain behaviors and bring them into the criminal realm. But there are changes here to the Security of Information Act, to the Criminal Code, which does criminalize certain foreign interference activities, from basic spreading of disinformation to try and meddle in party nominations. Things that were sort of in a gray area before are being very clearly, sharply defined as criminal behavior. What's the significance of that?
That's useful in the sense, if it's defined as criminal behavior, because it allows you to take action against somebody who doesn't disclose that they're doing those things, and subsequently you find out they are, and that would allow you to prosecute them. In the past, if it wasn't a crime, then even if you found out, there's nothing you can do about it, because they're not committing a criminal act. So that's useful. Intelligence evidence issue is a very, very broad issue and won't get fixed by this legislation, because it's really fundamental, at its fundamentals, a constitutional issue.
Yeah.
And you can't, unless you wanted to, notwithstand the Constitution, you really can't fix that one overnight.
Yeah, that's really...
I mean, there have been a number of fixes over the years, and the way in which the RCMP and CSIS in particular cooperate now has fixed some of those issues. But the reality is, that's a constitutional issue. Unless the courts step back from that, their interpretation to date, then that's not fully fixable.
Right. So it seems like in terms of trying to influence certain things on behalf of a foreign agency, a foreign actor, or a foreign state, there is the new registry they're proposing with the new Foreign Influence and Transparency Commissioner, which forces you to register there and be subject to fines and penalties if you do not register and engage in certain activity. But then there's also just criminalizing meddling in the electoral process, whether it's everything from a school board election to a nomination. So that seems to clean up some of those challenges at the school board and lower levels of state activity, does it not?
Yeah,
at least in terms of legal
framework. It makes it much clearer. It allows you to enforce the law if you identify somebody who is actually doing that without having registered. If they've registered, then they've declared it, it helps you when they're doing it in some sense in a more clandestine fashion.
Is that how you
deal with the people who are totally clandestine and who are never going to tell you anyway?
Right, but on that, it seems to me there's influence activity that needs to be registered with the registry, and then there's trying to interfere in electoral processes,
yes.
And they
You're
seem
right.
to be two
You're
separate
right.
things. Right, one is purely criminal, and the other is the registry compliance. So because for example, using the example of Don Valley North, which you've been talking about, the buses of students that were alleged to have come in allegedly with China's involvement, that's now very clearly criminal,
yes,
if this legislation passes. But on the registry, just help me understand that word, because this is something the United States has had for 8-9 decades. Australia's had for about 5-6 years now. What does that exactly curb? Is it just a transparency measure, or is it sort of a way that if you haven't registered and you're engaging in pressure on diaspora communities, we can get you this way? It's a bit like a Al Capone and tax evasion thing.
It does do that, and I think the example that a lot of people give is the example in the United States under their registration legislation. They were able to arrest two Chinese officials who were
right.
busy putting pressure on Chinese citizens in the United States. That clearly is something that the registry would deal with. It will also, I think, clarify who in society is representing a foreign government in their day-to-day dealings, which up until now we may not have known. It may be interesting to know, for example, who is working for the government of India or who is working for the government of China. Up until now, we really haven't known who is receiving a stipend to do things for the Chinese or the Indians or others. And I think that's not a bad thing to know in society. And ultimately, if you don't register, that allows you to be prosecuted as well. It won't do much about the rest of foreign interference. It's not going to fix the problem for communities, diaspora communities in Canada. It's just simply not going to do that, because the reality is their problems are different, and most of the pressure that's put on them is put on them by clandestine agents who aren't going to come and tell us that they're doing what they're doing or register or whatever. I mean, they may in fact be agents of a foreign power, and in some cases they may be Canadian citizens who believe that the foreign government, that we need to be closer to that particular foreign government, and we need to be agreeing with that foreign government, and therefore they want to encourage people in Canada to support that foreign government's position rather than the government of Canada's position. How do you prosecute those people?
Right. So how do you get at that problem, just as a final point? How do you get at people who are pressuring diaspora members? Because this has been the consistent theme throughout everything, is that they have been getting pressured, they say, for decades, especially in the Chinese-Canadian community, and it's not being dealt with. Is there a measure here?
No, not. I don't see one. Although some of the criminal effect may give you a leg up in some cases, depending on how it goes. I think the reality is that ultimately depends on intelligence work and identifying who are the practitioners. Some are harder to eliminate than others. For example, it's very hard to deal with the Iranians who do a lot of it over the telephone. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with stuff that comes over WeChat? Tell people to not listen to WeChat, but that's about the only solution you've got.
Okay. Ward Elcock, former director of CSIS, always appreciate the time. Thanks for coming in today, sir.
A pleasure.
The government is finally fulfilling its promise to set up a foreign agents registry, and it wants to make acting against Canadian interests on behalf of a foreign entity an indictable offence. Public Safety Minister Dominic Leblanc says today's legislation is aimed at addressing evolving threats to Canadian democracy.
With an act respecting countering foreign interference, we're taking action to adapt and to respond to a world where life and consequently threats are increasingly moving to the online realm.
All right, the Power Panel has been listening in as the government announced its new piece of legislation, its proposed bill. Brad Levine is a former communications director for the NDP. Here with me in the studio, Vandana Kotter is a former advisor to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Gary Keller is a former chief of staff to conservative cabinet ministers. And Rob Russo is a former CBC parliamentary bureau chief. All right, gang, good to see you. We've had, Vandana, a lot of activity on the foreign interference file since Justice Ugg tabled her report, and now we have this legislation. What do you make of what we've seen about these proposals so far?
I think you've seen a huge modernization of the tools that CSIS needs. And I think you can see that the government is taking all the pieces that can affect foreign interference, some diaspora communities' pieces, the evolving nature of foreign interference, and how it's permeating all society. So I was really pulled to the broad strokes piece of it, so that sharing information with municipalities, with universities, with corporations, mm-hmm. I think that's really important. But I think you're seeing that, over the last year, we've learned so much about foreign interference. And in my time in government, these hits on things that I've seen in the past that I'm like, ooh, that would have been useful.
Right.
Or things that I've identified. And something as simple as, I was told of a story where agents were going to Carabram, which is a multicultural festival the city of Brampton holds, saying they can't have a Punjab pavilion. So, I mean, that's something interesting that would be useful to a municipality, that would be useful to say that, whether it's official or not, I didn't actually end up knowing anything about that, but right. If they can share that information, that would be useful, and it protects diaspora communities, which is, many of them have come here to escape these type of regimes, but you don't want to increase bias towards them or suspicion towards them. So I think that really hits that sweet spot there to make sure we're protecting those communities, but also overall showing Canadians that this is something that's been raised, something that they're taking very seriously, and I think it actually came in a very timely manner, but not just a little, hit or here and there, but a huge, huge modernization.
Okay. There's a couple of key things that they touch on in this legislation. One is changing how CSIS operates to some degree. One is setting up a Foreign Influence and Transparency Commissioner, and others criminal changes to deal with foreign influence. Just want to stick with the CSIS changes if I can, Gary, just to whip through that before we dig more into it, just because if we go, it's so sprawling, we'll lose focus. They're changing the way CSIS can share information, as Vandana touched on, universities, businesses, other levels of government. This seems like a very important and necessary change based on all of the issues we've seen through the various attempts to study this concern.
Well, that's right. And I don't think you can take today's development in a silo. Obviously, with Justice Marie-Josée Hogue's first report out yesterday, what was striking about her first report is how different it was than from David Johnson's report, the see no evil, hear no evil, say no evil approach to studying foreign interference.
The conclusions were very similar.
But there was, you know, for example, where he said nothing to do with Han Dong in that nomination. Justice Hogue found a very different situation there. And I think there are very different shades. On the CSIS, on the sharing of information, I think that is really, really important, especially with parliamentarians. We saw this week how there was some sort of mishap where information wasn't shared with mm-hmm. parliamentarians. That is very important. But it's also very important for the much lower levels of government, because we have seen those stories, especially in British Columbia and Ontario, where we have seen school board elections or local small communities where you have, you know, the local councillors. There's, you know, four local councillors are being jetted off to China to study relations between Canada and China. You know, those have raised questions in the past. And now the ability for CSIS to share that information, of course, how much information, what type of information, that will all be debated as we debate this bill in the House of Commons. But I think it's definitely a very interesting point to be debated.
Rob, the ability to go right down to the school board level and tell people there, you know, that, hey, this country is trying to meddle in this election, this is what to look out for, helps people build resilience at every level of this, and also in research and industry and in business.
Yeah. But what do they do about it? What I want to know is, what will they be able to do about it? It's at the local level as well as the nomination level outside the RIP period. That is low risk, high reward activity, right? You don't have to do a lot if you're a foreign government to actually obtain results. So what are they prepared to do about it? Will the parties, political parties, get ahead of this themselves? Or are they going to wait to be embarrassed, potentially? Will they reform their own nomination processes? There's all kinds of evidence of Chinese police stations here. Mm-hmm. Sir, what will this do in a practical way to crack down on them? I'd like to see those mechanisms to look at those kinds of activities and how they're going to change behavior now. Because let's face it, a lot of this is being done by diplomats. And you can't prosecute diplomats. You can expel them, but you can't prosecute them. I think a lot of the change is going to have to be required here. Just like I think that the change to, I called it remote work for CSIS. They don't have to leave home, but they'll be able now to do some work overseas. You know, What kind of change is this going to foster here among domestic actors before this legislation actually has to be applied? Will it have that coercive effect before it's applied?
Well, you know, Brad, it does give CSIS the ability to speak to municipal governments about their municipal elections in a way they haven't been able to do it before. They can speak to businesses who are maybe being targeted for industrial espionage in a way they haven't been able to do it before. And just to jump ahead to the other things, the foreign registry that they've set up, the Foreign Influence and Transparency Commission, if you're doing any actions on behalf of a foreign actor and you don't register with the government, you can now face serious fines and jail time. So there's a legal framework being proposed here that has been missing, and Canada has been rightfully criticized for being way too slow on compared to other Five Eye countries. But they've brought it in, and they've criminalized basic foreign influence at a basic level from spreading misinformation all the way up to meddling in elections at every level of the democratic process. So it seeks to attack a problem they have been accused of ignoring for far too long.
Yeah, let's talk about the registry for a second, because I think that's very, very important. The Americans have had one for mm-hmm. many decades. The Australians brought in one about 5 years ago. Now, I think it's good. Canada's been talking about this now for a number of years, and I think that having a registry is right and proper. But I also would want to point out that if you're a foreign actor and you do not have a desire to be transparent, mm-hmm. you are not going to register. You are going to be potentially an individual actor where you don't register. And so a lot of these, one of the criticisms of the Australian one is that there are known entities that are associated with the Chinese government that aren't on their registry. And they know that they exist in Australia. And so it helps shine the light there. But the other thing is, those that want to apply the dark arts here aren't going to be registering. The other thing is how do you then find out? Is because you're going to need a a police force almost to go around and see who is violating the terms of the registry, who's not on it that should be, and also who's on it that is violating that. Because a lot of this interference isn't public. It's not known to a lot of people. So there's going to need to be a mechanism in there, or mechanisms to, you know, for whistleblowing, for calling it out. Because without a force doing it, looking into the incidences, you're not going to have much success with the registry. So it has to have some clout to it, it has to have some teeth to it, and it has to have mechanisms to make sure that those that are sneaking underneath it also get caught up with our... get caught up with the officials.
But Vandana, one of the concerns we've heard over the past year and a bit that we've been talking about foreign interference, police agencies saying that spreading misinformation on behalf of a foreign government isn't a crime. Well, it will be when this is passed. So the existing police forces now have criminal code, or will have, you know, Security of Information Act provisions that they can apply. You know, general foreign interference committed for a foreign entity could be misinformation. Indictable offense committed for a foreign entity, such as extortion or bribery, right? As we've seen in the South Asian community. I don't know if that links back necessarily to a government, but you see diaspora communities targeted. And then there's political interference for a foreign entity. That's the elections, and that's everything at the nominations. There's now a legal mechanism for police forces to use.
Yeah,
should this pass?
I think it shows how robust this is, because misinformation is increasingly such a prevalent thing in our society. You see it online, you've seen it with the U.S. elections, you've seen it here, and people don't know what to believe in. And, you know, you know that media, traditional media, is becoming smaller and smaller. So, you know, how do you know that person on TikTok or on Twitter, or what's believable or not? And I think sharing that information, saying that's going to be an indictable offense, is going to be important and help to, like, at least... You know, again, going back to what Rob said about coerciveness and putting teeth to it, I think that really will help fundamentally, you know, show these state actors that Canada is serious about this and we're serious about misinformation. But also, most importantly, show Canadians that they can have, you know, belief in their institutions, they can believe in the electoral process, and also help them know that we are, that the government is taking this on.
Gary, you know, to Brad's point, there's going to be bad actors who are going to live outside any law that you bring in. But on this, criminalizing these specific acts as foreign interference and giving sort of police an opportunity, I still don't know how they overcome intelligence to evidence, but, you know, gathering evidence that speak to these crimes. What do you make of this change that's being proposed here?
Well, it's not just the intelligence to evidence continuum. Mm-hmm. It's also just the sheer staffing and being able to actually do the investigatory work. Our police forces are stretched thin already, and I think it's fair to say even both CSIS and CSE have challenges in recruiting. This is a massive expansion of powers and information sharing, what's being proposed here. Do our police services across the country and at the national level with both the RCMP and with CSIS and CSE have the ability to actually do this work? If they don't have the ability to do this work, then these are just nice words on a page. If they can't carry out these investigatory powers, then we have a continued problem, and we'll see foreign interference continue to fester in this country.
But the criticism was they never had the powers, right? Now,
yeah,
now it's being proposed,
absolutely.
Right? So you've got to start somewhere,
yeah,
right? I guess.
And that's why the debate in the House of Commons, I think, will be really important on the
Well, in committee, in terms of what they do and when experts come in. Rob, what's your sense of that? Having the foreign registry set up, you know, which is something that has been pushed for. I mean, some of the penalties here, millions of dollars in fines, up to life in prison, depending on what you do. And there's other changes to things such as sabotage laws, which have been updated for the first time in a half century,
right,
to deal with more modern infrastructure that would cover things like malware and even bots.
Look, I think the lobbying register is a very, very good tool. It's not used often enough by reporters, to be perfectly honest with you. There is a great deal of information there. There are a couple of lobbyists on this panel. I'd like to hear from them how they're...
I helped to establish the Accountability Act, okay. So it's a good thing, Rob. It's a good thing.
They're all going to be fired if Mr. Holly ever...
I actually believe that it's a good tool, and it tells us that the town is stiff with lobbyists, and there's a lot of money sloshing around, and I'm not sure that that's going to change no matter what Pierre Poilievre is threatening after the next election. But I think that's good, and it works. I just wish it had happened earlier. It's been 86 years since the United States had the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and they were still able to use it as recently as last year to arrest two Chinese nationals for, in essence, intimidating Chinese citizens in the United States. Now, it's true that we have not been the target this kind of thing until the last little while. But it would have been nice for this to have been in place earlier than it has been. Yes, it's a good thing that it's here now. Let's hope that if it isn't it isn't given royal assent ahead of the October 25 election, that the parties themselves change their behavior. I really hope that that happens, as well as those in the lobbying industry.
If this isn't passed and approved and given royal assent before the next election, Brad, then nobody in the House of Commons deserves to be reelected, right? I mean, given all of the focus and the attention and the energy on this, I mean, maybe there needs to be changes and all that sort of thing. But it seems there is an urgency to get this done. I know there may be a delay in certain things coming into force, like setting up the commissioner's office, because that's going to take time. You need to give people time to adjust their behavior so there isn't, you know, forced criminality on people who haven't had time to deal with it. But this coming after the conclusions we got from Justice Ogg on Friday that, a couple of concerns in specific ridings, but broadly at the high level, things sort of held. I mean, where do you think this leaves things right now in terms of restoring and rebuilding the damaged confidence that's out there?
Well, I think in any opposition party that wants to delay this and ensure that it doesn't get passed before the next election, which I'd put to a year to 18 months from now, would have to have a compelling case to be made here. Like, what? I mean, this has been studied for many, many years. The topic has been studied for many years. It's quite comprehensive. It's going to go through the parliamentary process. There's no reason in the world. I mean, this is quite a lengthy thing, and I'll admit to you, David, I have not read the whole bill as of this taping. Yes, I apologize. I was too busy with the lobbyist registry. No. No, but they would have to make a compelling case. And they would have to make the case to Canadians, anybody that wants this delayed, to say that, it's better to go into the next election exposed to the inadequacies of the current toolkit for everybody. But I just want to pick up on a point about political parties whether or not they have to, up their game in terms of it. Some of the interference that we've been seeing, and I think the way I've overseen national election campaigns with, over 300 candidates, it is a massive undertaking for a political party. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, when it's done in a minority context and it's not set to a fixed election date, those elections can come pretty quickly. And so while I think the political parties can play a role in ensuring that its processes are fair and clean, and I would hope that they would blow the whistle if they saw any interference, we also have to, understand that political parties don't have all the same tools that either the federal government has or that CSIS do in order to keep an eye open for these things and prosecute them also. I just, I hope all parties play their role, but I don't think that it can be fixed exclusively by the parties themselves. They just don't have the bandwidth or the tools, but they can play an important role.
But, Vandana, it is interesting, and I agree with Brad. I mean, it's difficult to expect, small political parties, for example, even to meet the same level of robust standards at a larger political party. But if you look at this, and for those of you following along at home, on page 30 and 31 of the legislation, it does talk about the nomination of a candidate or the development of an electoral platform by a political party. Seeking to influence that on behalf of a foreign state is now a crime. I am not alleging criminality in what happened in Don Valley North, but if the allegations spelled out that the Chinese consulate arranged to have non-citizens go in to help pick a candidate, this would now deal with that through a criminal framework rather than counting on the parties to come up with the guardrails strong enough to protect things. That's my reading of it. How do you see it?
I think they see that this is a problem that a central, like I've worked central campaigns, I've worked local campaigns, you can't see everything. You can hope for the best that on the ground they can pay attention, but if buses come in, which happens in every nomination I've seen pretty much, people can say, yes, this person brought these 30 people, but you may not always know who those people are. So I think, putting that on the candidate themselves or the candidates themselves can be difficult. I don't know how you would find protocols to deal with that. So I think this is the best way possible. But also, it puts candidates on guard themselves. You know, to right. have that mysterious uncle come in, or that mysterious person, or the volunteer comes in saying, I'll bring you 10 buses. And before you're like, yeah, that's great. Now you might be like, why do you have 10 buses? Mm. And I think that's important. I think taking that pressure off the parties themselves shows that this is supposed to be going ahead in like a nonpartisan fashion. Doesn't give anyone, you know, a leap ahead here. But I think they know that this is something that is really important for democracy. It's important for our country. And then that's why they have to do that.
Gary, is that enough of a deterrence, do you think, to stop sort of meddling at the nomination riding level? I know this is, from what we've seen from Justice Ogg and others, that it's really confined to a couple of geographic areas and a couple of very specific ridings. But, you know, this is every person who commits an offense under subsection 1, which is what this is liable to imprisonment for life. Now, I don't know if stacking buses would put you in jail for life, but it does create a framework where that can be punished. Is that enough of a deterrent, do you think?
Well, foreign actors will always try to find loopholes in legislation and ways around this.
Yeah,
but I think throwing it back on the parties, look, parties have the right and leaders have the right to nominate the candidates of their choice. At the same time, we have a patchwork in this country of who can vote in leadership and nomination contests. I think it's ridiculous in this country that we allow 14-year-olds to vote in party nominations and party leadership campaigns, that we allow permanent residents and non-citizens to vote in these. If there's one unified standard that should be applied, it should be Canadian citizens, 18 years of age and older, just like we do for the voting system. I think if Elections Canada puts
even for nominations, you wouldn't let 16-year-olds vote?
I would not let 16-year-olds vote. We have to vote an 18-year-old in a national election. You have to vote that way in a party nomination.
See, Rob, I'd let 16-year-olds vote in the national election. If you can pay taxes and work, you should be allowed to vote. But that's just, you know, that's just my... But yes, I take Gary's point that that is the law as it exists right now.
We should make it easy. I agree with Gary. We shouldn't make it easy for foreign governments
of course to
meddle. And I think that's one of the intriguing unanswered questions after Madame Justice Ogg's first report, particularly when it comes to Don Valley North. The Prime Minister testified that he was aware of what was going on, didn't think it was serious. He was going to revisit it afterwards. But she said that she saw no evidence necessarily that he had revisited the issue. I think it will be intriguing to see if she goes back and examines that question again and what she concludes. So in other words, the Prime Minister knew something was going on. We still don't know what he did about it and when he did.
Right. I can't remember the specifics, but some information was given to him during the campaign and some after the election. So the timeline of when he knew things, but the party did say they were going to follow up. It's unclear what follow-up they necessarily did.
And what steps he might have taken, if any, to deal with it.
Right. Okay. Brad, quick last word to you, and then we got to say goodbye.
Yeah, I just want to, I mean, on the point of Gary about who can vote, and I mean, At this point in our country, political parties are not public entities. These are not public. Essentially they're private associations, and they can make up the rules as to who wants to participate, who can vote at nomination meetings. I don't see the taking what happened at Don Valley North and the Liberal nomination with a bunch of international students and tying that to what age you can be in there. If there's a problem with international students being bullied by their governments that have sent them over here to study, then we should take care of that before making up solutions to problems we don't have.
Yeah. I mean, look, not to make Gary's point for him, but the students accused at the heart of this allegation are non-permanent residents, non-citizens, who were living in the country as they went to school.
And we have a patchwork. We have that patchwork amongst the parties.
There's no question about it. And maybe foreign interference, as it becomes more widely understood, may necessitate a significant change.
And Elections Canada does govern funding of nominations. You have to report. That's in the Elections Act.
Right. Okay. All right. So clearly, a lot more to talk about on this legislation they dropped on us at 4 o'clock today, but we've done our best. So I want to thank the power panel for being with me today. Brad Levine, Vonda Nakatter, Gary Keller, and Rob Russo. Thanks so much, gang.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. All right, up next, the federal government is also shaking up how Canada's spy agency collects and shares intelligence. Up next, former CSIS Director Ward Elcock, and if these new powers will help the agency curb foreign interference.
Ram Power Days are here. The power to choose from the most awarded truck brand over the last 5 years. Like Ram Classic, as versatile as it is capable. Ram 1500, voted best large pickup in Canada. Or Ram Heavy Duty, with a no-charge Cummins turbo diesel engine. The power is yours. The time is now. Get 20% off MSRP on Ram Classic for up to $14,200 in discounts. Plus, get 4.99% financing.
Summer starts now. The new DQ Summer Blizzard menu. New peanut butter cookie dough party. New picnic peach cobbler. And more delicious flavors. Start summer now. Only at DQ. Happy tastes good.
It's the Spring It On event at Leon's. Get amazing deals on furniture. Save up to 50% on select clearance mattresses. Save up to $1,000 on select appliance and TV packages. Spring into savings today.
Why burn a candle when you can switch to Airwick Essential Mist? It's the modern way to transform fragrance infused with natural essential oils into a mist. Airwick Essential Mist. Connect to nature.
My family loves to travel. And I love it when they all come back home.
Toffee Fig combines what everyone loves. Caramel, hazelnut, nougat cream, and chocolate.
Don't let airborne allergens scare you. Arius provides fast relief of your 15 worst allergy symptoms, so you can love the air again. Arius.
The all-new GoDaddy Aero helps you get your business online in minutes with the power of AI. With the perfect name, a great logo, and a beautiful website. Just start with a domain, a few clicks, and you're in business. Make now the future at godaddy.ca/aero.
The federal government has tabled legislation that would modernize how Canada's spy agency collects and shares intelligence. The legislation comes days after a public inquiry said attempts by other countries to meddle in Canada's past two elections undermined Canadians' trust in democracy.
Digital technologies are a part of every aspect of our lives, and this new context calls for CSIS to be more agile in how it can conduct its investigations. This is precisely what this legislation would achieve.
For more on this, I'm joined by Ward Elcock, who is a former director of CSIS. Ward, long time no see. It's just Friday you were here. You heard there from Dominic Lebon talking about this will allow CSIS to be more agile in the way it conducts its investigations. How does this boost the agility of the spy agency?
Well, I assume what it does, and it's a fairly long piece of legislation, mm-hmm. and a lot of it is fairly complex, so understanding exactly what every provision does is not something you can do in 20 minutes
or
half an
hour. Of course, of course.
But I assume what they're doing is they're tidying up a bunch of things that deal with investigation, but also clearly they're giving the service a greater ability to talk to people about issues that may come up in investigations. Now, that's going to create its own problems, but that was something the government signaled that it intended to do.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about the importance of that because, you know, throughout this, like there's the internal information sharing gaps of whether the PMO was told or the public safety minister was told. This is about a broader series of information sharing at municipal governments, you know, at universities and private companies. What is the benefit of giving CSIS that specific range of powers and any downside you might see?
Well, the benefits are that it can talk to people because up until this point, the service was limited really to providing information to the government and then the government deciding what it would do with it.
Right.
So giving the service the ability to do that means that it can be more direct. It will be more challenging for the service because it will have to take some decisions about what information does it share and doesn't share. And there is a potential to create problems in an investigation by sharing too much. I think some of people's concerns that people be informed are probably unrealistic. Really, for example, it escapes me that Mr. Chong needed to know that the Chinese were interested in finding out something about his relatives. It's not clear to me, apart from the fact that he is a member of parliament, why that would even be an issue.
Why wouldn't he want to know that? I mean, if it feels...
There's nothing he can do about it, and there's nothing the service can really do about it, except if somebody actually carries out that activity in Canada. But the reality is the Chinese are going to find that information out in China. They control Hong Kong. They're not going to have any barrier to finding that information. They may have tried to do it here for simplicity, but ultimately they'll get that information at home, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
So the argument today in allowing CSIS to speak more broadly with people was that it could help build resilience. For example, we've heard about alleged meddling by the Chinese state in the Vancouver municipal elections, for example. And we've heard from the former mayor, Kennedy Stewart, that they were briefed by CSIS on what was happening, but it was maddening because of the lack of specificity.
And they may still have that problem.
Right.
Because, again, you're talking about top secret information. It may be information derived from a warrant. It may be information derived from a sensitive operation from
right.
a human source or whatever. So the information they share may still not be enough, the kind of information that people imagine they should be getting. Now, whether they should be getting it or not is a question that the service is going to have to consider before it shares anything, and that's going to be tough to manage, I think.
There would at least be the opportunity, as I understand it, the way these changes were explained today, is that you could go to an organization, a municipality, a company or whatever, and say, you're being targeted by a foreign state. These are the ways they tend to do this. These are the steps you should take to protect yourselves. And right now, they haven't been able to do that necessarily.
So there are ways in which they can do some of that and ways in which we have done some of that in the past. But the reality is that was hard to do. This will make it easier, and that will happen more easily. And that's not a bad thing necessarily, but it will involve some tough choices from time to time.
It's still unclear to me how a legislative framework that we've only just seen could help overcome the challenges of turning intelligence into evidence to take certain behaviors and bring them into the criminal realm. But there are changes here to the Security of Information Act, to the Criminal Code, which does criminalize certain foreign interference activities, from basic spreading of disinformation to try and meddle in party nominations. Things that were sort of in a gray area before are being very clearly, sharply defined as criminal behavior. What's the significance of that?
That's useful in the sense if it's defined as criminal behavior, because it allows you to take action against somebody who doesn't disclose that they're doing those things, and subsequently you find out they are, and that would allow you to prosecute them. In the past, if it wasn't a crime, then even if you found out, there's nothing you can do about it because they're not committing a criminal act. So that's useful. Intelligence evidence issue is a very, very broad issue and won't get fixed by this legislation because it's really fundamental, at its fundamentals, a constitutional issue.
Yeah.
And you can't, unless you wanted to notwithstand the Constitution, you really can't fix that one overnight.
Yeah, that's really...
I mean, there have been a number of fixes over the years, and the way in which the RCMP and CSIS in particular cooperate now has fixed some of those issues. But the reality is that's a constitutional issue. Unless the courts step back from that, their interpretation to date, then that's not fully fixable.
Right. So it seems like in terms of like trying to influence certain things on behalf of a foreign agency, a foreign actor, or a foreign state, there is the new registry they're proposing with the new Foreign Influence and Transparency Commissioner, which forces you to register there and be subject to fines and penalties if you do not register and engage in certain activity. But then there's also just criminalizing meddling in the electoral process, whether it's everything from a school board election to a nomination. So that seems to clean up some of those challenges at the school board and lower levels of state activity, does it not?
Yeah,
at least in terms of legal
framework. It makes it much clearer. It allows you to enforce the law if you identify somebody who is actually doing that without having registered. If they've registered, then it's they've declared it, and it's but it's really it helps you when they're doing it in some sense in a more clandestine fashion.
Is that
they
how you
deal with the people who are totally clandestine and who are never going to tell you anyway?
Right, but on that, it seems to me there's influence activity that needs to be registered with the registry, and then there's trying to interfere in electoral processes,
yes.
And they
You're
seem
right.
to be two
You're
separate
right.
things. Right, one is purely criminal, and the other is the registry compliance. So because for example, using the example of Don Valley North, which you've been talking about, the buses of students that were alleged to have come in allegedly with China's involvement, that's now very clearly criminal
yes.
if this legislation passes. But on the registry, just help me understand that word, because this is something the United States has had for 8-9 decades. Australia's had for about 5-6 years now. What does that exactly curb, is your saying? Is it just a transparency measure, or is it sort of a way that if you haven't registered and you're engaging in pressure on diaspora communities, we can get you this way? It's a bit like a Al Capone and tax evasion thing.
It does do that, and I think the example that a lot of people give is the example in the United States under their registration legislation. They were able to arrest two Chinese officials who were
right.
busy putting pressure on Chinese citizens in the United States. That clearly is something that the registry would deal with. It will also, I think, clarify who in society is representing a foreign government in their day-to-day dealings, which up until now we may not have known. It may be interesting to know, for example, who is working for the government of India or who is working for the government of China. Up until now, we really haven't known who is receiving a stipend to do things for the Chinese or the Indians or others. And I think that's not a bad thing to know in society. And ultimately, if you don't register, that allows you to be prosecuted as well. It won't do much about the rest of foreign interference. It's not going to fix the problem for communities, diaspora communities in Canada. It's just simply not going to do that because the reality is their problems are different, and most of the pressure that's put on them is put on them by clandestine agents who aren't going to come and tell us that they're doing what they're doing or a register or whatever. I mean, they may in fact be agents of a foreign power, and in some cases they may be Canadian citizens who believe that the foreign government, that we need to be closer to that particular foreign government, and we need to be agreeing with that foreign government, and therefore they want to encourage people in Canada to support that foreign government's position rather than the government of Canada's position. How do you prosecute those people?
Right. So how do you get at that problem, just as a final point? How do you get at people who are pressuring diaspora members? Because this has been the consistent theme throughout everything, is that they have been getting pressured, they say, for decades, especially in the Chinese-Canadian community, and it's not being dealt with. Is there a measure here?
No, not. I don't see one, although some of the criminal effect may give you a leg up in some cases, depending on how it goes. I think the reality is that ultimately depends on intelligence work and identifying who are the practitioners. Some are harder to eliminate than others. For example, it's very hard to deal with the Iranians who do a lot of it over the telephone. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with stuff that comes over WeChat? Tell people to not listen to WeChat, but that's about the only solution you've got.
Okay. Ward Elcock, former director of CSIS, always appreciate the time. Thanks for coming in today, sir.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. All right, up next, Hamas accepts a new ceasefire proposal, but Israel says the deal Hamas has agreed to may not be acceptable to Israel.
We are at a critical stage right now.
This news comes just hours after Israel told people sheltering in Rafah to evacuate, warning of a military ground operation. Will Israel and Hamas be able to come to an agreement, or will this war continue to escalate? We've got two experts standing by to weigh in.
It's odd how, in an instant, things can transform. Slipping out of balance into free fall.
The stock market is now down 23%.
This is happening, people.
Where there are so few certainties.
Look around.
As we navigate a future unknown. I'm glad I found stability amidst it all. Gold. Standing the test of time.
Gnarly! Back in my day, I used to call this the 180 spice bomb. Watch this.
Oh, that was awesome!
Oh. Fix Auto! The first words that you come to mind after an accident.
Hey, wake up. The words in your head, you're the only one that can hear them. Say it. Yes, I can. Move. Feel it. Hold on to this feeling. Yes, I can. Yes, I must. Watch me.
Rent Peloton Bike or Bike Plus at onepeloton.ca. Terms apply.
There's a reason Ram has been the most awarded truck brand over the last 5 years. Everything we build is from the ground up. Every great idea, every next idea, every truck, and everything in it. Like the Ram 1500, awarded number one in new vehicle quality by J.D. Power. We put everything we have into our award-winning trucks, so you get everything out of them. Ram. Trucks are what we do.
Coffee run, anyone?
I'm grabbing lunch. Any requests? Race, yeah. Tim's has flatbread pizza now.
There's a new Tim's run in town with new flatbread pizza. Served hot out of the oven and freshly prepared in chicken parmesan, pepperoni, simply cheese, and bacon everything. Tim's new flatbread pizza.
Parrots are incredible animals.
Another overdue bill?
They're also extremely intelligent.
Forgot to pay again!
And they also repeat things they hear a lot. The new BMO Eclipse Rise Visa card rewards you with points for paying your bill on time every month to help build a routine.
Rewards you with points!
And you get 5 times the points on things like groceries, dining, recurring bill payments.
For paying your bill.
But also you get...
Every month!
And just remember...
Build a routine! Huh?
He is a talker.
When a bank helps you make real financial progress, that's the BMO effect. BMO.
Time now for the 5 other key stories we're watching today. First, a Winnipeg man has admitted in court that he killed 4 women in 2022. But his lawyers are asking that he be found not criminally responsible because of mental illness. Jeremy Skibicki has pleaded not guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of 3 First Nations women, Morgan Harris, Mercedes Myron, and Rebecca Contois, and a 4th unidentified woman known as Buffalo Woman. Police say the remains of at least 2 of the women are believed to be in landfills in the Winnipeg area. The Speaker of the Ontario Legislature has loosened a ban on wearing the keffiyeh at Queen's Park.
Members, staff, and visitors wearing the keffiyeh will be permitted entry to the legislative precinct. However, in line with my previous statements in the House, the keffiyeh is not permitted to be worn in the chamber or the galleries.
But that shift didn't stop 3 MPPs who opposed the ban from defying it today and wearing the scarf in the chamber.
Sarah Jama, you are named. You must leave the chamber. I must warn the member for Ottawa Centre. The member for Hamilton Centre is warned.
Sarah Jama, an independent MPP, put on the scarf as question period started. Members of the NDP caucus, Ottawa's Joel Harden and Hamilton's Kristen Wong Tam, also put on scarves and left in solidarity with Jama. A keffiyeh is a checkered scarf typically worn in Arab cultures and has come to symbolize solidarity with Palestinians.
The keffiyeh ban being reversed in the rest of this building shows that there was no merit to this ban in the first place, that this ban is a bit of political theater.
This is an unjust rule. It's an unfair ban.
Canada's spy agency says the Israel-Hamas war has led to a spike in violent rhetoric from extremist actors. It warns that the spike could prompt some in Canada to turn to violence. The Canadian Security Intelligence Service says it is clear the conflict has raised tensions within the country, particularly since Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel. The president of the European Union says it's relying on China to influence Russia to end its aggression against Ukraine.
Europe and China have a shared interest in peace and security. We count on China to use all its influence on Russia to end Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine.
In Paris, China's President Xi Jinping met with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. They discussed the war in Ukraine and growing trade tensions over Chinese electric cars and French cognac. It is the Chinese president's first visit to the EU in 5 years. The judge overseeing Donald Trump's criminal hush money case says if Trump violates his gag order again, he could end up in jail.
He's taken away my constitutional right to speak.
Trump was fined $1,000 for the 10th time today and held in contempt of court for violating the gag order. The gag order prohibits Trump from making public comments about jurors, witnesses, and families of the judge and prosecutors. New York law allows fines of up to $1,000 or jail time of up to 30 days for violating a court-imposed gag order. Hamas announced today that it has accepted a mediated ceasefire proposal, but Israel says the deal Hamas has agreed to may not be acceptable to Israel. The details of the proposal are still unknown, but the White House says it is working with Israel to review Hamas's response.
The last thing I would ever want to do from this podium is say something that could put this very sensitive process at greater risk. We are at a critical stage right now. We got a response from Hamas. I mean, my goodness, folks, I don't know that it gets any more sensitive than right now. And the worst thing that we can do is start speculating about what's in it.
This news comes hours after Israel told Palestinians in some areas of Rafah to evacuate. Israel has said repeatedly it will launch a ground attack in the southern Gaza city, where more than a million people uprooted by the war have been sheltering. The Israeli military says it is using text messages, airdrop flyers, and social media to alert roughly 100,000 people in the eastern parts of Rafah. Israel says it will push on with its operation in Rafah, even as its negotiators examine the proposed ceasefire agreement. Rhonda Sleem is a senior fellow and director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues program at the Middle East Institute. And John Allen is the former Canadian ambassador to Israel. They're going to walk us through all of this and what's been a confusing day. It's good to see you both. So Rhonda, what do you make of this? Hamas, I jumped when I saw that they had accepted a ceasefire proposal, but then we find out Israel has rejected it because what Hamas has accepted is not what Israel says it has agreed to. Translate this. How should we assess this?
Well, I mean, by the way, I mean, reports on the ground in Rafah are saying that there is already an operation taking place, Israeli operation involving bombardment, artillery shelling on the eastern part of Rafah. So whatever Israel wanted to do in Rafah has started. Whether this is going to be a limited operation or the big ground invasion, we don't know. So what Hamas has done is say, you know, basically they accepted this proposal that was put forward and negotiated not only with the Qataris and the Egyptians, but also with the director of the CIA, Ambassador Burns, which says that whatever framework for a proposal has emerged has been, you know, has emerged out of these discussions and acknowledged and accepted by the United States. Now, the Israeli prime minister has, I think, lots of pressure from inside his war cabinet, especially the right-wing elements, not to accept the proposal. At the same time, there are the families of the hostages and other segments of the Israeli society that want the proposal to go forward. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, you have an American president who really wants this proposal to be approved by Israel, maybe with some amendments. So where we are today is that Israeli Prime Minister has said, I'm going to send my negotiator back to Cairo. Hamas is sending back its negotiators to Cairo. And then the negotiations will continue on whatever has been accepted by Hamas until now.
John, how do you view the developments of the past few hours?
Well, I think the key here is that we don't really know what's in this proposal. We've never known exactly what has been negotiated. We know the broad elements of it. The bottom line continues to be, does the proposal speak of a temporary ceasefire, or does it speak of the end of the conflict? We know that up until now, the Israelis have said they're not going to accept an end of conflict proposal, and Hamas has said just the opposite. So that's really where are we at? What does the proposal actually say? I agree that, you know, the Americans have been involved. I would expect if this proposal actually said that Hamas accepts a temporary ceasefire going forward and wants to begin the exchange of prisoners for hostages, I think it would be hard to believe that Bibi and company would refuse it. So there still seems to be some details that will be negotiated. As was said, this is a limited operation so far. Limited, people are being killed, houses are being destroyed, but this is not the ground operation that everybody is so concerned about that would be a complete and utter humanitarian disaster. Israel doesn't have the troops in Gaza right now to proceed with a ground operation, so this is limited. They're asking 100,000 people who have already moved, I don't know how many times, to move again. It's from a specific area where they obviously believe either specific tunnels or Hamas leaders or parts of these battalions are located. We're going to have to see over the next couple of days how it proceeds. But I agree. Biden wants this. The hostage families want this. Hamas appears to want it, although, you know, 2 days ago, Hamas launched rockets from Rafah, killed 4 Israelis, injured 11. That doesn't sound like a side that is interested in peace, especially when Rafah's at the heart of this humanitarian potential disaster. So there's games being played, I think, on all sides still.
Well, so Rhonda, on that point, right, there have been the missiles shot into Israel, as John outlined, and now we have this limited operation happening in Rafah that, once again, forcing the displacement of people into other areas of Gaza that have already been flattened throughout this conflict. If there is no willingness from Mr. Netanyahu to accept a permanent end and no willingness by Hamas to accept a temporary pause in the conflict, how does this get overcome at all? Or is this just a public relations exercise being played out today to try to maybe stop the Rafah activity from happening?
Now, I mean, John is correct. We don't know for sure what are the contents of this proposal, but at least, analists that are close to Hamas, as well as diplomats in the region, have been leaking some elements of this deal.
Right.
And it calls for, 100 plus days, 100, in fact, 24 days of pause, if we can put it this way, over 3 phases, during which Israel will get all of its hostages, civilian, military. It will get everybody, of course, who is alive. It will get the, you know, unfortunately, the bodies of its citizens who were killed, you know, tragically. And then Hamas will get a temporary hold, you know, on the hostilities. It will get release of Palestinian prisoners at a much larger number than the Israeli hostages. But also, I think what is the sweetener to the deal right now is supposedly what the Americans have been, you know, promising the regional mediator, or have been saying to the regional mediator, and what the American administration has been saying a few times, including Secretary Blinken during his last visit to the region, is that this temporary halt, which is of hostilities, which is, you know, about 120 some days, maybe could create or open the political space to build toward a permanent ceasefire, you know, and that required other negotiation. So basically what the Americans are hoping is that they create a new fait accompli on the ground, where both sides will become somehow interested and incentivized to continue with this ceasefire long term. But also what has happened in the last rounds of negotiation, especially during the meeting between Secretary Blinken and foreign ministers of 6 Arab countries, is the promise that these Arab countries have made through their foreign minister of a large amount of aid toward the reconstruction of Gaza. And that has been the sweetener that has been added to the deal, which right. has not existed until now.
So John, on the domestic situation, you said that you can't imagine a scenario where if it was only a temporary pause in hostilities that Hamas agreed to, that Benjamin Netanyahu would say no. We're seeing the Jordanian foreign minister saying that Netanyahu is jeopardizing the ceasefire potential now by bombing Rafah. What do you think the domestic situation is like right now for the Israeli government with these leaks and counter-leaks and assessments coming out about what's on the table here?
Well, the as we've mentioned, the pressure is on Bibi with respect to the hostages. There are many, many Israelis that are demonstrating in the streets now, increasing numbers, and many Israelis who really believe that the hostages should have been a priority from day one and should be right now. And as we mentioned, he's also got a lot of pressure from Joe Biden, which he has up until now ignored, and we know all about that. But on the other hand, he's got Ben-Gavir and Smotrich and other very right-wing people who are holding up his coalition and who have said that if you agree to an end of conflict, we're out of your government right now. Yeah. And that is, you know, and many people say, and I tend to agree, one of Bibi's main concerns is Bibi here trying to protect the interests of the hostage families and the people of Israel, or is he as concerned or more concerned about this government falling apart and then him ending up at a trial, etc., losing power? Mm-hmm. Nobody knows that answer either, but he's definitely under conflicting pressure, and I think he's telling different things to different people. I think when he sits for 2.5 hours with Blinken and when he talks to Biden for an hour on the phone, he leaves one impression, and then when he goes and he talks to Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, he promises them that he's never going to let Hamas leaders out, and he's going to go into Rafah, etc., etc. And I'm not sure he knows what he's going to do ultimately.
Okay. Rhonda Saleem with the Middle East Institute and former Canadian Ambassador to Israel, John Ellen. It feels like it's going to be a big week. Don't be surprised if we call you again. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.